Welcome to another episode of Disrupt. I'm Bailey Bryant with Home Healthcare News. In this episode, you'll hear from Brent Cortee. He's the Executive Director of Evergreen Health Home Care, which has been on the front lines of the fight against the coronavirus in the U.S. since day one. But before we get into that conversation, I want to give a shout out to our podcast sponsor, Homecare Homebase. Its powerful, cloud-based home health software streamlines virtually every aspect of your business. Spend less time on paperwork and more time delivering quality care to the patients who need you. Visit hchb.com to learn more. Now, another thing you're probably trying to learn more about these days is how to best position your agency to deal with the coronavirus. That means changing protocols, preparing staff, getting enough PPE, and navigating cash flow issues. While a lot of you are probably working through those questions now, Cortee has been grappling with them since February. His agency is a nonprofit in the Seattle area that does about 250,000 visits per year. It's affiliated with a small local hospital there where the country's first coronavirus death was recorded. While Evergreen Health is still very much grappling with the COVID-19 emergency, Cortee and I talked about what they've learned so far, how he would do things differently if he could, and how agencies not yet in the eye of the storm can prepare themselves. Here's what he had to say. Hi, Brent. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I know things are crazy out there. How are you doing today?
I'm okay. How are you, Bailey?
I'm doing good, all things considered. As you know, I think everyone is grappling with this coronavirus craziness. So out there at Evergreen Health, you've been dealing with this for, I think, a month and a half now. Can you quickly walk me through your backstory on that and maybe what a day in your life looks like today?
Sure. On February 28th, I was about to go to bed. It was the evening on Friday, February 28th, and I got a phone call from my boss. She asked me if I was sitting down, and I told her no, I wasn't. I was actually putting my daughter to bed, and I was laying down about to go to sleep myself, and she said, well, I need to talk. She told me that the first death in the United States occurred at our hospital with a COVID-positive patient, and I'll never forget sitting up and walking out of the room and just a flood of ideas and consequence and everything just sort of ran through my head. And of course I had many questions, and my next question to her was, you know, what happened? And I was happy to hear that really Evergreen Health as a hospital had stepped up to respond to a need in the community where this patient obviously hadn't contracted COVID-19 at our hospital, but our hospital had chosen to step up and support and care for this patient who needed care. And, you know, I was immediately proud to be part of that group. And at the same time, I was overwhelmed with the idea that this was happening not only in the United States, not only in Washington State, and not only in Kirkland, Washington, in the Seattle area, but at the system where I work and lead our home care division. It was a lot to deal with, and I can tell you that my personality is, immediately put worry or concern to work. So I got up next morning and headed in early and worked with the hospital leadership to prop up our incident command, and spent many, many hours over that first weekend and week working through the proper way to deal with a crisis of a virus which, frankly, very few people really understood. So I was very, very fortunate to be part of a system that was dealing with this head on. And in some abstract way, I actually think that it's been a good thing that Evergreen Health and Kirkland were the first to experience coronavirus, because for a couple reasons. One, Washington State was one of the first states to, quote, fully flatten the curve because we had aggressive social distancing early. It also allowed us to prepare very quickly. It forced us, should be the better term, to prepare very quickly for what life is like in the healthcare world in the pandemic. It allowed us to lean on some of our best practices and a lot of the work that we've been training, a lot of the training we've had around dealing with crisis and disaster. It was like a tabletop drill that I will certainly never forget. The first 24 hours, again, I don't think there was any sleep in the first 24 hours. In fast forwarding through the weeks, we've gone from somewhere from adrenaline to something that feels more normal, given that we've spent now a month and a half building processes, protecting our staff, finding PPE, and doing everything we could to try to face this crisis pragmatically, scientifically, and bravely.
What's been the hardest part of doing that?
You know, the hardest part, frankly, has been making decisions that keep our clinicians safe, knowing that we have had limitations on everything from knowledge about the virus early on to limitations on PPE. It's been so important to find that balance between how we keep our clinicians safe and meet the community where they need us, which is in their homes right now. And I tell you that it's kept me up many, many nights, me asking myself, have I done everything to keep our folks safe? If our clinicians aren't safe, then we can't provide care. And they, without a doubt, have been our absolute priority. And we lean on science to keep our staff protected, and we lean on compassion to keep them supported. I mentioned before that this is a global pandemic, but fear is a very individual thing. And with around 600 team members, we've had 600 different reactions to the crisis. And keeping our staff safe doesn't only mean safety and protection from the virus. It means making sure that they're supported in all ways, making sure that they're able to support their family, that they're receiving paychecks, and that they're emotionally supported too.
Definitely. A big part of that safety is PPE. This is something that everyone around the country is struggling to get their hands on. You want to have enough, but you don't want to take too much so that another health system or hospital or home health provider can't protect their workforce. So I'm curious if you could walk me through those decision-making processes and the current day PPE protocols that you use.
All right. Great question. Considering that on day one, all we knew of the virus really was from news reports and some local communication. And frankly, we were fortunate to have some communication internally about preparing, and it was very sound communication. It was really difficult for us to figure PPE out. And we're fortunate to have the support of an excellent infection control team, both at our Evergreen Health System, but also within Evergreen Health Home Care. We have spent years preparing our staff to understand proper infection control. Our first move was to evaluate our PPE inventory. And I can tell you that we looked great under normal times, but like many folks in the United States, we weren't prepared. We weren't prepared for a viral outbreak or a pandemic. We started by effectively doing what the hospital was doing, which was using N95 respirators for positive patients. And then we moved on from that, knowing that droplet precautions were sound and safe for positive patients if done correctly. Now, that included goggles, gown, gloves, and surgical mask. And then we laid off the gowns. And then we went to no masks at all, except for positive patients, and then went to masking for all patients. And now we are working to provide cloth masks for patients who can tolerate them. Now, another thing that's super important to mention here, Bailey, is that procurement is important, but conservation is critical. Now, we have continually said, do we want to have 2 weeks of being overly protected, or do we want to have 2 months of being adequately protected? At the time, it was very wise of our CNO and of our infectious disease doc, Dr. Frank Rito, to really bring home the idea that a mask save now is a mask used later to protect someone. So conservation couldn't be more important. It's also super important to hold your medical supplier accountable. Push back if they're only providing PPE based on allocation. You know, medical suppliers are going through a very tough time too. They're all working very, very hard. In the same right, to lean on a mentality of allocation when we've never needed an allocation for massive PPE nationally, no one has, then it doesn't seem to make a ton of sense. Now, there are agencies whose clinicians are at risk right now because they're not getting the supplies that they need. This isn't only risky for clinical staff, but it's risky for the community because it compounds the spread of the virus unnecessarily. I mean, people expect healthcare employees to be fully protected. And healthcare employees should expect to be protected. It's what they're trained to do, and it's certainly not, it's a right, not a privilege. And I know I've spoken with my colleague on the NAC board, Ken Albert, who has recently dealt with this. I reached out to him today about it. I know he's still working very hard, and he's been faced with a decision which is very common. I was faced with the same one, which is, do we send staff out into the community to provide care to COVID-positive patients who are not fully protected? And there's no graver decision. And the answer is no. We would not do that, and we cannot do that. We have to protect our staff so our staff can protect the community.
Definitely. I know that staff seem to be a central part of your coronavirus response. Have you implemented any special initiatives to thank your workers on the front line during this difficult time, or doing anything special on that front?
Yeah, you know, we've done quite a bit. A couple examples I can provide. We've offered meals, and frankly, the community has offered meals from local restaurants to help feed our staff. I know we've had all manner of food, including much comfort food. It seems that in the COVID-19 era, that mac and cheese is very well received by our staff. And we've had a number of local folks donate money to restaurants that supports the restaurant and also supports our staff. So that's one thing. We've also worked really hard to be accessible to our staff via not only via email, but weekly town hall meetings. So we don't generally have, even in the course of a quarter or 6 months, have a town hall meeting where every one of our staff members calls in. We've been doing them weekly now, and now we've separated them out to be specific to our hospice inpatient, our hospice home care, and then our home health. Also, our spiritual care department has been calling all of our employees to check in on them and to thank them and remind them that they are seen and that they're appreciated. Now, this is an outstanding program that's been led by one of our hospice managers who has done a great job. The other great part of it is that they have been able to glean feedback from our whole body of staff to make sure that we understand what kind of communications that they're hoping for. So we're doing everything we can to try to prop up our staff and support them.
Yeah. Another interesting aspect we've heard from a lot of home health providers is that they've seen changes to supply and demand. Some people have told us that they've seen demand decrease because seniors are maybe refusing visits and elective surgeries are down. Meanwhile, others say that they have more folks at home, so they maybe don't need as much help as they normally would. I'm curious what you're experiencing.
That's an important question, and it's one that's been surfacing more and more in the last couple of days. Now, there's a lot happening here. We are obviously wanting to focus on supporting our staff. I mentioned how important it is to keep them safe and how important it is to make sure that we are still out there in the community. Now, from a supply and demand perspective, this COVID-19 has really obscured the so-called economics of home care. Our patients needed us before February 28th. They need us now, and they're going to need us after there's a vaccine for COVID or we're able to move forward in a more normal way in society. That hasn't stopped the need. COVID hasn't stopped the need. In fact, it's probably compounded the need, but there's a lot of factors at play. We're seeing our clinicians be denied access to congregate living facilities, and we have respect for assisted living facilities, absolutely, and respect for what's called in Washington an adult family home. However, I think it's important that the entire community, the healthcare community especially, recognize that the work home care providers are doing is the work that keeps patients out of hospitals. And for us to be seen as a possible vector is logical. But what isn't logical necessarily is that care would be withheld or prohibited from patients who have that need. And we're working hard with our facility partners in the community to make sure that our clinicians have access. What's really happened, a couple examples are that we've seen a significant decrease in our total number of visits. I think if off the top of my head, I think that hospice has seen just under 50% decrease in visits, and home health has seen about just over 25%. So I think home health is right at 26% decrease in visits. So on the home health side, that's a big deal. Not only does that, we have never considered that any of our visits were superfluous. And in this time, the visits are absolutely needed. So to have a decrease in visits has impacted our ability to make sure that our patients are not deconditioning, that they are not at increased risk of going back in the hospital. Because as we know, that does not lower the curve, that increases the curve. On the hospice front, in spite of our decrease in visits, we have seen a sharp increase in telephonic interactions, and we're working on virtual care. And I think that that's helped quite a bit. We also are working really hard to ensure that we're supporting our therapy team. You know, therapy's in a tough situation right now. We have seen a sharp increase in nursing, but our therapy visits have probably seen the most drastic decrease. And like I said before, the need for home health and the need for therapy was there before COVID. It's here during, and it's going to remain needed after. So we're working to support our therapists in different ways. In the same right, are doing everything we can to make sure that they know that this is that we're a long-term sustainable employer for them, and that we reinforce how great of a place hopefully it is to work here, even through this tough time when they have fewer hours.
Why are you seeing that drop in therapy, do you think?
You know, decline in therapy referrals and visits, it has been drastic. We, you know, like the rest of the United States, we are going to welcome elective surgeries coming back with open arms. Not having elective surgeries has been quite a decrease. We've also, I mentioned that the bit of prohibition of therapists from entering assisted living facilities and congregate homes, that's had quite a significant impact. Patients are coming out of hospitals highly deconditioned and needing expert help with ADLs. Now, this need didn't abate when the outbreak started, and I personally feel it's very risky for all healthcare staff to not have access to patients who need the care. Home health professionals are the front line who will keep patients from going into already inundated acute care settings, and we need therapists out there to make sure that our folks are moving around, that they're getting up out of their chairs and they're exercising, especially because they're more homebound. The verb of being homebound has become more restrictive. They are more homebound than they ever were before. I mean, heck, the most, 97% of the United States is homebound right now. So I have respect for the fact that many assisted living administrators are trying to limit access for the public, but I think it's very, very important that everyone remember that home health and hospice and home care employees are really the front line from a community perspective of healthcare in the United States. And therapists play an absolutely key role in that.
Yeah. How, if at all, are you reassigning those therapists or reworking their schedules when they might not be as busy, but I'm sure you have need across the organization for all hands on deck?
Yeah. You know, great question. We're fortunate to be part of a hospital system that's very supportive. And we have many options for our therapy staff, as well as other staff members. We've seen a decrease in hours. Many have been part of our system's labor pool. So we have an open labor pool where they can come support various COVID-related needs at the hospital. Others have chosen to go on FMLA or simply are just decreasing their hours temporarily. As an organization, we're choosing to support our staff through allowing them to keep their benefits in light of a decreased workload and giving them access to accrued sick pay and EIB hours to supplement their income, which are, you know, frankly, from a cost perspective, those are very costly decisions. In the same right, I don't think Evergreen Health batted an eye at it. I mean, what the most important part of our organization is our people, and we are doing everything we can to support them. And the way I keep asking myself about my decisions, Bailey, is, am I going to be proud of this when the vaccine is out and this is over? Will I be proud of the decisions that I made and proud of the organization that I work for? And I think some of these tactics to keep therapists and other staff supported have been very important.
Yeah. Now, this discussion around therapy and visit volume, it brings me into a question I have about PDGM. I'm curious about what implications COVID-19 has in light of PDGM. For example, how are you grappling with or avoiding things like LUPAs and other issues that could arise?
About a week and a half into the COVID crisis, our team just had this moment when we were in our incident command center, and the home health leaders all looked up and just said, wow, weren't we already working on what was going to be our hardest year ever? And, you know, we half laughed and half kind of sulked in our chairs and then, you know, kept working through it. I think back again to day one, February 28th. I had just gotten back from a road trip with my 9 and 7-year-olds in the Southwest. I was preparing for a ski trip in the Canadian Rockies, which would have actually been taking place right now. And we held that morning, that day, on February 28th, we held our regular PDGM planning meeting, which we had religiously. And very detailed plans to address PDGM, and we've been fortunate enough to speak on our plans at the national level, and we were really hoping to test them, and we were excited to see our March and April numbers, and which really, if you think about the impacts of PDGM, the impact was never going to express itself financially or statistically until March or April because latency within the former payment model PPS. And then COVID took over the healthcare, the national healthcare system, and PDGM seemed to take a backseat. But I want to clarify: in all of our work, PDGM hasn't been forgotten. It's been part of all of our decision making. But when you're having to make a choice between what PPE keeps our clinicians safe in this moment to make sure that they don't get this terrible infection, and you know, have we coded for all of our comorbidities through PDGM? We're going to choose the former, and we certainly did. So 2 years of planning, and it honestly took a pandemic to slow down our momentum around PDGM. So, you know, part of this is LUPAs. We've started to look at LUPAs very pragmatically. We aren't going to force a clinician to do a certain amount of visits which aren't necessary under the veil of COVID. We feel that LUPA numbers, the actual LUPA minimum number, is really an effective benchmark for an absolute minimum number of visits that a home health provider should be doing. So if after all the statistical and regression analysis that CMS did, if after all of that they came up with what could be the right number for a certain type of patient with a certain type of comorbidity that came from a certain location, then for us, that can act as the minimum amount of visits we should be doing. So we've really aimed at that being our minimum amount of visits, whereas before, frankly, we were doing a heck of a lot more than the LUPA number. And then we supplement that number, those visits, with telephonic interactions significantly. So we are working really hard at communicating with our patients to keep them out of the hospital. The other bit, if I can mention, is therapy utilization. So just experiencing a lower therapy utilization, we talked about this earlier, it's a tough situation. And we know the need for therapy will continue, but we have to make sure that our therapists are continuing to go out, because if our patients continue to decondition, then they're going to put stresses on the healthcare system that the healthcare system wasn't built for. Now, we know the healthcare system was built for an average critical mass without a pandemic. And now that we have the pandemic, we're seeing healthcare systems get quite creative. But this, again, is home care, home health, and hospice's critical role is meeting our patients in the community where they need us and keeping them home safely.
Definitely. So would you say that any of those areas have been pain points for you, or that you've been able to successfully kind of navigate the differences in therapy utilization and the LUPAs and all of that in light of COVID-19?
Truth is, we have seen a sharp increase in LUPAs. The problem is with that, I'd be giving you statistics if I had them. I can't tell you the difference between what our January and February LUPA numbers are, because many of those LUPAs were still based on latency from PPS. So we have a strong assumption that our LUPAs have sharply increased, or what our LUPAs would have been, more importantly, has sharply increased. And we do know that therapy utilization has decreased. Now, through PDGM, therapy was not as formally incentivized as it was through PPS. So, you know, if we're able to provide visits in some form financially from a revenue perspective and from a breaking through the LUPA ceiling perspective, then perhaps we'll be okay. But we are very, very cognizant of ensuring that we provide a minimum amount of visits. And this harkens back to a key consideration that I hope every leader in home health in particular is asking, which is, what is the balance between protecting our patients in their home and their situation, their individual situation, and protecting the public's health? Now, it isn't appropriate that people have parties right now. It isn't appropriate that people go to the store too often or that people ignore social distancing. But it is appropriate, I feel, that home health clinicians and hospice clinicians and home care staff and clinicians are able to have access to their patients, because we are the folks that are going to help keep them home safely and help this national lockdown, which I heard it was called today, to be sustainable for folks that need care. And I think one last point is, a socially relegated. And we are able to provide that human touch, and let's assume it's less of a physical touch and more of a reaching out, even when we're in the home. But it's so important to acknowledge that folks, in particular seniors, who are otherwise isolated already, I mean, we all feel it now. People who are not able to go to work are feeling what this isolation must be. So it's another reason that's so critical that we're able to get into people's homes and make sure that they have the care they deserve.
Definitely. Now, looking back at more of a broader view of this whole issue, if you could go back in time a month and a half ago, would you have done anything different in handling this? And if so, what?
Wow. Let me think. So I would, if I go back in time, I would have changed my bachelor's degree in microbiology to a degree in epidemiology. So I'll give you that one.
I like that answer.
Yeah. I would have ordered a stockpile of PPE to keep on hand for times like this. I would have heeded warnings more carefully about epidemics and viral spread. I would have done as much as possible to get to know the patients that we've lost before they were infected. I'd be more outspoken for the need for our country to support public health and post-acute care and home care, hospice, and home health in the way that we support the defense as a nation. I would have read more articles based on science and never questioned that science or thought that this simply wouldn't happen because it's not convenient. And, you know, lastly, I'll share something I wouldn't change. I wouldn't change the team that I have around me. I'm just incredibly fortunate to have such a solid group of leaders, and you know, they inspire me, they keep me running, I learn from them, and I couldn't be luckier to be surrounded by this group of people.
I think that's great. I know you and your leadership team have been very vocal in trying to help other home health care agencies nationwide. So for someone who maybe hasn't been on one of the webinars you've done or some of the advice you've put out, what wisdom would you like to share with other agencies who are maybe not yet in the same position that you are, but are definitely preparing for or starting to deal with the coronavirus in their own right?
Yeah, thanks for the question. You know, I looked this up the other day simply because I was curious what the formal definition of wisdom was. And wisdom is essentially a combination of knowledge, good judgment, and experience. And you look back at those three things, and one thing that none of us have is experience in a pandemic. In fact, perhaps I'm wrong about that. Maybe there could be some folks that have had limited experience with West African pandemics for Ebola, et cetera. But for the most part, none of us do. And I can tell you that what's worked for us, and the biggest advice and wisdom I have for other agencies, is to get your leadership team together right now and agree upon your approach, talk through difficulties, have conversations about the elephant in the room, and make sure that you iron out where everyone stands before this hits you. Once it's there, you're not going to have time to deal with mission-level issues. These are tough conversations, and they should happen now. As a leader, enter all conversations with an open mind. Few of us have, like I said earlier, have been through this before. And the only other thing I think it's so important to mention is that it's critical we support our staff and we see them for what they're doing and for the risks that they're taking. We need to provide them constant information and give them the support they deserve. And I think that the home care industry, the hospice and home health all together are, we highly value our people because we are in the business of people. Our provision of care is people caring for other people, so we have to keep our people safe.
Yeah. I'd just like to end things with asking you, what impact, if any, do you think the coronavirus will have long-term on the home-based care industry? Obviously, this is shining a light on the importance of caring for folks in their home. You're able to isolate them. You are showing that you can care for higher acuity patients in the home. I'm curious, what impact do you think this will have long term?
Wow. Well, without a doubt, there's going to be a higher recognition of home care, of home health, and of hospice, of the need for more support, knowledge of, and funding of home-based care. I think that right now, as they probably should be, acute care centers and hospitals have been a large focus because we've all seen what's happening in New York. And again, for anyone listening from New York, if I can take the liberty of speaking on behalf of our industry, our hearts are beating for you. And what you all have been through out there has been unprecedented and unbelievable. So we have nothing but support and care for you, and not only in New York, but anyone else who's been through these difficult times. You're definitely seen and supported. As far as the industry goes, I hope that this is going to lead towards more progressive regulatory considerations, more considerations towards virtual care, more considerations towards telehealth, and hopefully home care will continue to have a louder voice in conversations at the top levels of government to ensure that we have a seat at the table that is positioned to our relevance, and we couldn't be better positioned to provide care to the United States than the home care industry is. We already do this work. We know what it's like. We know what windshield time is like. We know what it's like to knock on a door and to pet a dog that we've never seen or to run from a dog. You know, we understand how to provide this care, and we understand one fundamental thing that's so important, that people go to hospitals to be treated, but they go home to recover. And what we do is help them recover at home.
Brent, well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much, and good luck out there.
Thank you, Bailey.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Disrupt. For more news and insights on the home health, home care, and hospice industries, subscribe to our daily and weekly newsletters. You can do that at homehealthcarenews.com. I'm Bailey Bryant, and this has been a production of Aging Media Network out of Chicago, Illinois.